Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
One of the educations you receive very quickly as a new aide in the White House is just how fraught the world is in terms of potential threats and challenges. And it was a comfort to me that one of my colleagues was John Brennan, who was the Homeland Security Advisor to the President and now the CIA Director. Director Brennan came by the Institute of Politics the night before, met with Donald Trump and the leaders of the intelligence community to discuss the Russian hacking story. And we sat down to talk about his life, his career, and some of the very interesting current events. John Brennan, Director of the CIA, welcome. Thank you, first of all, for coming to the Institute of Politics, and thanks for your friendship over the years. We were colleagues in the White House, but I didn't know then what I know now because of the research that I was given before this conversation, that we had this thing in common, which is we're both the sons of immigrant parents. Tell me about your dad. He's from Ireland.
Yes, my dad, Owen Brennan, who passed away last week.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to be his wake and funeral is this weekend up in New Jersey. Lived to 96 and a half. Tremendous inspiration and role model for me. Was a blacksmith and a farrier. Came to this country at the age of 28 in 1948. Loved this country, found a wonderful woman, raised a family, had a work ethic that was second to none, and integrity and moral character that I wish I could be half the man my father was and who continues to be an inspiration to me.
And you grew up in Jersey City?
I was born in Jersey City. I grew up in Hudson County, New Jersey, first West New York and then North Bergen, which is right across from Manhattan.
I have. This is another link we have here because my grandparents lived in Jersey City, so I spent a lot of time in Jersey City, going to Greenspan's Deli. I don't know if you ever buy Greenspan's in Jersey City.
I play a lot of basketball in Jersey City.
I know. I wanted to ask you that. Jumping Jack is what I heard, and I was surprised about that just because I've met you later in life, and the knees are a little creaky now.
Yeah, well, after three hip replacements and one knee replacement and a number of surgeries, I don't have the same jumping capability I had back then. But at one point I was able to dunk, and at 6 foot.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Basketball was my love when I was young, and I always hoped to have an NBA career. I think I may have decided that that might not be in the offing, but I still just love the game.
There was a guy, he was a little bit older than us, Billy Cunningham, remember him?
Oh, yes,
from
pretty much so, yeah.
Erasmus High School in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was also a huge leaper. Way beyond his size.
Yes.
Another Irish guy.
Yeah.
Another Irish leaper. And Catholicism was very fundamental in your...
Yeah, well, I was raised in a very, not strict Catholic family, but a very strong Irish Catholic family. It was a blue-collar, lower-middle-class neighborhood, but and my father was... and worked construction, but they would save up their money so they could send me to Catholic school. And so I had Franciscan sisters in elementary school, Christian brothers in high school, and then Jesuits in college at Fordham University. And I joked that I was beaten and berated by, you know, many of the clergy of the Catholic Church. But it was a tremendous educational experience for me. There was discipline, but there was also a real investment in the moral fiber of students. And I was I always wanted to be the first American pope. That was what I really wanted to do up until high school, because I was planning to go into the seminary and then decided that that was not for me.
It's actually tough to get that job. You know? they don't just give it out.
Yeah. So. And my, you know, I don't have the faith that I had when I was young, but I like to believe that I have the spirituality as well as the moral compass that I developed because of my family, my parents, my early schooling. That's something that continues to be my North Star.
Yeah, I should have asked. I don't want to leave your family without asking about your mom.
Yeah, my mom is 95, and my they were married for 64 years, she is in New Jersey still, I have an older sister and a younger brother who are in the area where my mother lives, and my mother and father live together in an assisted living facility. But she was the daughter of Irish immigrants. Well, her grandparents were immigrants from Ireland, I had Irish on both sides.
A lot of singing and dancing, I understand.
Yes, there was quite a bit.
our friend Dennis McDonough was with us a few weeks ago, and I talked to him about the new pope, who's a Jesuit.
Yes, yeah.
And and Dennis allowed what that meant to him. First of all, have you interacted with the Pope at all?
Well, yes, I was invited to the White House for the when the Pope came and the arrival ceremony, and then I was introduced to him. And I remember vividly when I was on the line, and then when I got up to the Pope, and the President introduced me as the John Brennan, Director of CIA, and I could see the Pope's eyebrows go up a little bit, and then the President immediately said, "But he was Jesuit trained at Fordham," and so the Pope gave a smile and, you know, gave a warm handshake. But yeah, the Jesuits. I had a number of Jesuits at Fordham University, and especially on the philosophy courses, theology courses, they really did a lot in terms of my intellectual curiosity. And really stimulated thought. I find the Jesuits to be a tremendous, tremendous intellects. There's a special, I think, affinity to the Jesuits for those who were trained.
Do you see qualities in him that you recognize from those days, from the people who were your mentors?
Well, I do, in terms of the interest in mankind. As well as he is somebody who is not attracted by grandeur and worldly goods and material goods, and really has, I think, tried to share the concept that we are all children of God, and we need to, I think, take stock of what is happening in our world. And I can remember a number of my Jesuits in college who really opened up my eyes to the world and got me out of my northern New Jersey, New York environment and made me understand that I am just one person of billions and we're sort of all in this together. So the Pope is a very impressive individual.
When you, I want to follow that train of thought, but I just want to ask you one more question about him. When you guys do your analysis, I know he was deeply involved, for example, on the Cuba issue and was an impetus for some of the work that the president did in terms of beginning down that road.
So about the Pope or Dennis McDonough? Or both?
Both of them were active, but
right,
I'm giving the Pope a little more credit here because I think Dennis would insist. But do you guys, when you do your analysis, I mean, do you look at the Pope as sort of a geopolitical figure? Do you evaluate his impact?
If he is weighing in on something, mm-hmm. and if he is looked to for his thoughts or his involvement in something, yes. I mean, he is a world figure. And if the Catholic Church, if the Vatican gets involved in some type of, situation or crisis or whatever, but it's not something that we focus on in terms of.
We don't have a podcast.
We're not collecting against the Vatican. Let me assure you about that.
But so you talked about your eyes being open there. I'm interested in how you made this journey. You began to study a different part of the world. You learned Arabic. How did that? That's a long way from Hudson County.
It is. My cousin was in AID, and he was the Food for Peace officer in Indonesia. And he invited me to go out there in the summer of my freshman year of college. So I was able to convince one of my political science professors to allow me to do a tutorial. So at least I would get some credit for going out there and selling my toys. And so I traveled out to Indonesia, was out there for about 2 months, and did a paper on oil and politics in Indonesia, traveled across Java, motorcycled across Java, then went to Bali, spent a week there. And this was my first time out of the country, aside from Ireland when I was younger. And it really did open my eyes to different cultures, different religions, and also gave me a sense of just how huge this world is and how diverse it is, which stimulated then my wanderlust. And that's when I went to American University in Cairo in my junior year when I was at Fordham, because I went back after Indonesia, went back to northern Jersey, was commuting back and forth to Fordham. And my professor in sophomore year brought in a brochure. It was for the American University in Beirut, and I was planning to go there, but that was the year of the Civil War that AUB was closed down. So I then went to American University in Cairo. Never been to the Middle East before. It stimulated my interest in the region and the people and the language, and that's when I then pursued Arabic in graduate school and Middle East studies, and led to my postings then in the Middle East.
But you weren't doing that with a mind toward working for the CIA.
No, I just was trying to learn as much as I could about the world, I just enjoyed seeing new things and experiencing new cultures and new environments. And when I was in graduate school, I was in the doctoral program at the University of Texas. I got married at a young age of 22. And I think my wife was a little bit concerned I was getting too comfortable as a graduate student. And so I had an application from the CIA because I saw an advertisement in the New York Times that I sent in my resume for. And since I had some overseas travel, they said, well, why don't you pursue graduate studies? And if you have an interest in the CIA, send this application in. So as I said, my wife was concerned that I wasn't pulling my weight. And she said, send that application to the CIA, which I did. And I didn't know what I was going to encounter, but they offered me a job because I did have some Arabic and overseas experience. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I started the agency in operations and then had an opportunity to serve an interim assignment in the analytics side, and I felt that was a better match for me. So I spent most of my career at the agency on the analytics side and went back and forth between operations, though.
So analyzing raw data and interpreting their meaning, its meaning.
Reading reports that mm-hmm. were sent in to Langley from the State Department and others, and from intelligence that we acquired from sources, and evaluating that, and then writing reports for the president and
synthesizing it.
Yeah, and putting it together. And I found that something that I enjoyed. I enjoyed writing. I enjoyed briefing. And I had the opportunity to go out pretty early in my agency career, serving a rotation with the State Department at the American Embassy in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Back in the early 80s, the embassies were in Jeddah, not Riyadh. So I was out there for 2 years. So my wife and I went out there before children, and I went to a six-month tutorial Arabic. So my Arabic was pretty good at the time. And just traveled a lot, went off with the tribes for a week. Did a lot of hiking and camping, went down to Yemen, and just really enjoyed experiencing life outside of northern New Jersey.
Yeah, you couldn't get as far from northern New Jersey as that. When you first joined the CIA, had a rough decade in the 70s because of some of the scandals surrounding President Nixon, and there was a whole reevaluation of the how intelligence was done and managed and overseen. Did that give you any pause? Were you aware of it?
I was, because when I was at the University of Texas, in fact, we had some former CIA officers who would speak at UT, and some of them were quite critical of the agency. I remember Phil Pagey came down there one time. And that was after the Church and Pike Committee hearings that looked at some of the CIA activities that needed to be cleaned up. And that's when the Congress decided to have oversight committees in both the House and the Senate, inappropriately so. So, was I attracted to CIA because of what it stood for at the time? I had an interest in CIA because when I was young, I found out that Nathan Hale, the America's first spy, was hanged on September 22nd in 1776. I was born on September 22nd, 1955. So I remember when I was reading my history book and I saw that he was hanged on that date, it just stuck in my mind. I said, I will be a spy like Nathan Hale, but hopefully I won't have the same ending.
Yeah, I was going to say that. That's a little grim, actually, when you think about it. You talked, when you spoke to our students a few minutes ago, you talked about the fact that one of your early mentors, Robert Ames, was killed in the embassy attack in Beirut in 1983. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Bob Ames is a special person. There was a book that was written about him 2 years ago or so called The Good Spy by Kai Bird. And he was somebody who worked in the Middle East, was a very good Arabist, worked with Palestinians, lived in Yemen. He was an operations officer for most of his career. And then, toward the end of his career, he became the head of the analytic office that was responsible for the Near East and South Asia. That was the office that I was in before I went out to Saudi Arabia the first time. And when I was studying Arabic for those 6 months, I would frequently go into the office on the weekends, and he would be there, and he would test me in my Arabic. And he was a master Arabist. I was a rather novice Arabist at the time. And I really came to respect and admire him. And so that's why when he was 49 and he was on travel to the Middle East and he was at the embassy in Beirut, he was in the stairwell when that bomb went off, the truck bomb, and he was killed instantly. And it was 6 months before retirement. And his wife and family then were left without Bob. And his star is one of those on the memorial wall, one of the 117. And every year when we have our memorial ceremony, many of the family members of those stars come back year after year after year. And Bob's wife and some of his sons come back. So he is somebody who made such an imprint on me because he was such a specialist in intelligence. He was a tremendous Arabist. And he was somebody who I think had the integrity and professional talent that I wanted to emulate.
We had, by the way, also fairly recently, Steve Kerr, the coach of the Golden State Warriors, and his father, Malcolm Kerr, was assassinated in the 80s. An admirable public servant in his own right.
Absolutely.
So how did you process that then? Was that the first kind of loss that you experienced?
Yeah. I remember being in the embassy in my office when the names of the killed were coming across in cable. And I saw Robert Ames, and I said, maybe there's somebody at that embassy who also is the name Robert Ames. Bob Ames would be out there because he's back at headquarters. And when I found out that it was him, it was a tremendous shock. And it made very real the conflict, the violence, the bloodshed that was going on, because he was the first person that I knew personally who died at the hands of terrorists. I have known many others since then. But that was a very profound event in my life. It made me, I think, maybe redouble my interest in the Middle East, because of the example he set for me.
As roiled as the Middle East was then, it's in many ways more so now. I think that's fair to say. Where is this all going? I'm asking you this now because you have deep expertise in this region, but there's enormous anxiety for obvious reasons, and I'm wondering what you foresee.
I foresee more challenges ahead. Unfortunately, I foresee more violence and bloodshed. The Middle East is going through a very, very difficult phase of its history. And the Arab Spring, I thought, brought to the fore a lot of issues that needed to be addressed because there was repression in so many of these countries, authoritarian rulers who didn't take into account the interests of their citizens. Corruption still runs rampant in many, many countries. And we should not be just addressing the symptoms of the problems, the violence, the terrorism, the extremism. We really have to get to those underlying factors and condition that contribute to them. So it's the institutions of governance. It is the economic reforms that need to take place so that there can be opportunities for individuals to be part of a modern-day economy, to be able to have the opportunity to vote for the government leaders. They need to be able to have the type of education and schooling that they need in order to gain the skills to participate in a modern economy. Their judicial systems need to be revamped. So I know that there's a lot of focus, and CIA does focus a lot because that's our responsibility, on preventing those terrorist attacks. And we try to strengthen the security and intelligence services, which is very important. But you have to look behind in the pointy end of the spear. You have to have the reforms, the political reforms, the economic reforms, this disparity in wealth that continues to exist out there. And when I see the growth in terms of the numbers of people, the increasing urbanization, and so the next decade or more is going to be very challenging for a lot of these countries.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Director John Brennan. You know, I listened to you, and I thoroughly agree with you, but the mood of Americans is very much, or many Americans, very much inward looking. Now, there is a sense that this is their problem, and why do we have to get involved in it, the issue of resources and how much. There's the age-old thing about foreign aid, and which is less than 1% of the budget, but most Americans think it's a quarter of the budget. So at a time when you say that things are – you must have this concern about the fact that we have to make more investments at a time when people are inclined to make less.
Yeah, and I think we have to recognize that this is a tremendously interconnected world, and what happens overseas has impact on us here in the United States, both in terms of our national security as well as our economy, and we cannot isolate ourselves, and those oceans do not protect us from the influence of foreign events and developments. And I think about American exceptionalism in a different way than a lot of people. When people talk about American exceptionalism, I don't think we're certainly any better than anybody else. But we have had exceptional good fortune because of this great, bountiful country and our resources and our history and our experience. And we are the world's lone superpower. We really are. And as a result of that exceptional good fortune, I think we have exceptional responsibilities to do what we can to try to bring a semblance of peace and order to the rest of the world. And so retracting from that American involvement overseas and trying to just focus on ourselves, I think misses two things. One is misses the fact that we cannot isolate ourselves from global events. They have direct impact on us. And number two, if we're going to continue to be the world's greatest democracy and superpower, we need to make sure that we do what we can in order to help the rest of the world, because we are citizens of this world. And I don't think that we should turn away from the problems that are beyond our borders, because we are a country made up of people who have come from many, many parts of the world. And I think we need to do our part. And I think our part is a lot larger than other countries. And
you talk about the need for good governance and other reforms in many of these countries, but you also have sectarianism that often overwhelms the desire, the impulse for governance, or at least the goal of governance, and that's we've seen raging in the region. It seems more intense now. The autocrats, the one thing they seemed to be able to do was repress that, and so. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, it's interesting. When you look at on the global stage right now, there is both the rise and demise of nationalism and national identity. There are a number of countries where there is tremendous growth of nationalism from the standpoint of we don't want our identity, our nationality, to be diluted.
We've seen a little of that here, you know.
Absolutely. yes, and we're seeing it in Europe as well, and it's the reaction to more flows of immigration or whatever. But in a lot of other countries, you have a demise of that national identity. Right now, when I look across the Middle East, as well as Africa and South Asia, there are more and more people who identify with their tribe, with their religion, with their ethnic group, and not with the concept of being a Yemeni or being a Libyan. They are a Misratan, or they are something else, or they're a Shia or a Sunni. And that just feeds these tensions, these sectarian and other tensions that really undermine the concept of a nation state. So you're seeing a pull in different directions here. And I am concerned that if people are giving up on the nation state concept in a lot of these countries, there's going to be more conflict because people are going to try to stake out what their interests are as part of that subgroup, that subnational group. While at the same time, you have this increasing nationalism that is more and more antagonistic to those groups. So when I look out over the next decade or two, that both the rise and demise of nationalism, I think, is going to come into direct more tension, and particularly with the flows of people and populations. And it's not just because of conflict and civil strife. You know, I look at the displacement because of lack of economic opportunity, increasing displacement of people because our coasts are being reclaimed as a result of climate change, exactly, yeah. Which is going to lead to greater population flow. So we need to be looking at how we're going to give people a reason to stay where they are and to be able to develop opportunities in their countries and be able to work together as governments.
Let me just return to your biography for a second, because this is related to this discussion, Iraq. And you were at the CIA during the run-up to the war in Iraq. And you addressed this with the audience you just spoke to of students here. There are those who would argue, I think the president has made the argument, that the decision to go there, you've probably read his speech, remarkable speech. He was a state senator at the time. And he said that he was worried that this would unleash sectarian forces and a war of undetermined length and cost and consequences. I know that the president-elect has been critical of the intelligence at that time, but you yourself were critical, and you said in there that there are times when policymakers who want to achieve a goal cherry-pick their intelligence to try and support that goal. Is that what happened there?
I think that there were individuals in the Bush administration who were determined to have this Iraq policy and an invasion of Iraq, because they felt as though Saddam Hussein was a real threat to regional stability as well as to the United States.
You didn't feel that way?
I felt he certainly was a disruptive force, but I didn't feel that he was had posed that type of threat. This is where, and I was also talking about capabilities and intentions, and you see someone's military capabilities grow, but there was no indication that Saddam Hussein was going to use, even if he had BW or CW in large quantities at the time, to use it in order to carry out, you know, another invasion or whatever. I think President Bush at that time was misserved by people around him. It's a responsibility of the people around the president to make sure that the president gets the full array of information and intelligence, and not to cherry pick it in order to get the president to agree and support a certain policy path. And that's where intelligence is particularly important, that we don't just respond to a leading question, that we want to make sure, especially that the president has a full understanding and appreciation of what the risks, the opportunities are of different policy courses.
By the way, how important are these presidential daily briefings?
Very, very important. The information in them is something that I think every president, certainly going back to Nixon, has valued, because it will allow them to see developments, see trends, see situations that require the president's attention. And presidents receive the information in different ways. You know, some would want to get fully briefed on the book. Some would want to, you know, read the book first and then have a discussion. But I think staying abreast of the intelligence picture is important for any and every president.
So the obvious question is, does it concern you that the president-elect has not been a regular consumer of these briefings?
I know that the president-elect between Election Day and Inauguration Day is consumed with a lot of things, and I would not presume that they should take a briefing every day. I think it should be a regular occurrence, certainly. But the president-elect is still just the president-elect. I do think it's going to be very important for the president, the new president, on Inauguration Day, to have a regular engagement with the intelligence community and with the intelligence product and the PDB. Absolutely.
One of the very freighted issues that came up during that period and may have led to you leaving the agency for a period of time was the issue of enhanced interrogation tactics. And this whole debate over waterboarding and some of the other techniques. You had concerns about those.
At the time I was of 9/11 and the aftermath, I was the deputy executive director of CIA, which is basically the equivalent of a deputy chief operating officer. So I was not in the chain of command for it, but yet I was still a member of the senior leadership team. And I had expressed my concerns about them at the time to some individuals on the seventh floor of CIA. But I didn't, you know, hit my fist on the table. I didn't, you know, push the issue because it was a program that the President of the United States had authorized. It was a program that the Department of Justice had repeatedly reviewed for its legality. It was a program that a lot of people felt was essential to be able to prevent Al-Qaeda from carrying out another type of attack. And so I wasn't privy to a lot of the details of, you know, how it was being conducted. Looking back on it now, do I wish I would have spoken up more? Yes, absolutely. And so my reservations were expressed, but they were not expressed with the force that I think that I should have.
Then you were, and I was there for a period of time when you were the president's Homeland Security advisor in the White House, and you were an advocate for the steps that he took to ban some of these techniques. I'm sure you've been following closely this debate over whether some of them should be reinstated. Donald Trump said during the campaign that, you know, the people we're fighting are chopping off heads, and, you know, we ought to go back to doing waterboarding and some of these other things. What's the argument against that?
Well, I'm also glad that Donald Trump, when he listened to General Mattis, seemed to adjust his view about waterboarding and some of these EITs. I do believe that the Army Field Manual provides the necessary foundation for the interrogation and debriefings. The CIA was damaged quite a bit as a result of the experience with the EITs. I don't think it's something that we as an organization should be involved in. I don't think it's necessary. One can never establish cause and effect. I know a lot of my CIA colleagues, current and former, may disagree. But because somebody was subjected to an enhanced interrogation technique and subsequently provided accurate information does not mean that that was the only way to get that information, nor was it causative as far as what prompted an individual to ultimately give it up. And we know that individuals who were subjected to the EITs also gave a lot of false information and false leads.
To avoid them.
Yes, just to get them to stop.
That's Senator McCain's argument.
Yeah.
But there's another element, isn't there, which is the impact it has on our own security and on the security of troops in the field and on the general tenor of the struggle as a propaganda tool.
Yeah, and it has been used as a propaganda tool. I would say that the terrorists don't play by the same rules that we do. We shouldn't stoop to their tactics. Just the way we shouldn't stoop to the tactics that the Russians use against our elections, we shouldn't stoop to the tactics that terrorists use. And I do think that it is counterproductive because it can be used against us. I don't find that it has, it is the only way or even the way to get that information. The CIA is no longer in the detention business, much less the EIT business. I think that is appropriate. But I do remember also in the aftermath of 9/11, when there was this great concern about the follow-on waves of attacks, it was considered to be an existential threat to this country. And there were individuals who really were concerned that al-Qaeda had biological and chemical weapons they're going to use, and there were going to be another series of devastating attacks here. And a lot of people, well-meaning and motivated people, thought that these EITs were the only way to get this information. So the time was different. So looking back on it, it's I think easier to say that it never should have happened. But when the President of the United States gives the CIA an order, I must tell you that CIA officers tried to salute. That's why after 9/11, CIA boots were the first boots on the ground in Afghanistan within 2 weeks. The first American to die in Afghanistan after 9/11 was a CIA officer, Mike Spann.
Your passion for the agency is palpable. It was clear. You gave a great tribute to the men and women who do this work when you spoke to these young people. How did you feel when you read some of the tweets of the president-elect disparaging the work of the intelligence community and pointing back to Iraq, suggesting the intelligence community got that wrong, so why should we trust them on this Russia piece?
Well, I attribute it to the president-elect's lack of understanding about what the intelligence community does and our profession and just how important it is. There have been a lot of changes since the Iraq WMD issue. We have revamped a lot of the practices and procedures and the reviews that we do. I think the quality of the product is much stronger. I think our capabilities are greater. And I tell our workforce, those that may be reading those tweets or reading the press accounts, to make sure that they recognize that they now have a special responsibility to try to inform the new president about the global landscape as well as what it is that we know, what it is we assess. So I am very much hoping and counting on the new administration, new president, to treat the intelligence community and the CIA and the people of the CIA with the utmost respect. They can challenge our work, and the president-elect, when he becomes president, can certainly disagree with our assessments and our views. But at a minimum, our work, our sacrifices, our contributions to this country's security needs to be recognized, appreciated, and respected.
If that is not the case, if that doesn't happen, what are the consequences of that? I heard one of your colleagues at the Senate hearing today suggest that he feared that good people would leave the intelligence community because they'd become discouraged.
That's certainly possible because our people work more than a 40-hour week. Many of them could make much more money on the outside, but they serve at the agency because they really believe in the importance of the work and they believe in the mission. And if they feel as though that is not being appreciated or recognized or utilized, why would they make all those sacrifices, put their lives at risk, do the things that they do for their fellow Americans if they're not going to be...
What would the consequences for the country be?
I think they could be very, very serious, obviously. And the new administration and any president needs to recognize that this is a challenging and dangerous world, and that the intelligence community and intelligence professionals can help to keep this country safe and protect our national security interests. And any president or administration that does not recognize that is one that is putting this country's national security at great risk and peril.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Director Brennan. One of the proposals apparently the new administration is considering, according to the Wall Street Journal, is the elimination of, or at least the slimming down of the intelligence community, maybe the elimination, not the elimination of the intelligence, but of the DNI, the Director of Intelligence. That was a position created in response to 9/11, a coordinating position.
I think they've disavowed that. In fact, I think Sean Spicer said today that that's 100% inaccurate or whatever. And there is a report that that President-elect Trump is going to name Dan Coats, former senator from Indiana, as the new director of national intelligence.
You have confidence in him?
He is somebody who has been on the Intelligence Oversight Committee in the Senate. He's somebody who has taken his responsibility there very seriously. He appreciates and applauds the work that we have done. I have enjoyed my association with him. I think he is somebody who would serve that position well.
You also worked with General Flynn when he was in his position at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he was removed, I think, during your tenure there. What was your sense of him and his appreciation for the use of the importance of intelligence and its appropriate use?
He was the director of Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, mm-hmm. when I was the director of CIA. We testified together. I think he tried to do some things inside of DIA to be able to take advantage of their capabilities and authorities. As an intelligence officer, and he was an intelligence officer for most of his military career, I think he recognizes the importance of it. And I'm hoping that as National Security Advisor, he is going to take full advantage of the intelligence community's capabilities. So we'll have to see. But Mike Flynn, given his overseas experience in the war zones and his familiarity with the intelligence mission, I would find it – I'd be flabbergasted if he shunned intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So what is the deal with Russia? You've got a report coming out next week, and I don't expect you to be too forthcoming about its contents. But there's a lot that's on the public record already, including the fact that you and all of your colleagues in the intelligence community are of one mind that Russia did involve itself in our election. And as you pointed out in this group, they've also involved themselves in elections all over Europe. Great concern in Germany about that. What is the ultimate end game for them in this sort of campaign of disruption?
Well, I think what Mr. Putin seeks to do, and the intelligence agencies are his instruments to accomplish, is to shape the outcomes of elections so that the results will be more conducive to Russian interests. We have seen it happen in a number of places in terms of trying to work with corrupt politicians or using media sources to skew the perception of voters as well as the playing field. So this is something that will be coming out in this report. We have great confidence in our understanding, our knowledge, and our assessment of what took place. There are some things that we don't know, but there's a lot that we do know. And it's important for that to be exposed, not just for future elections here, so that safeguards can be taken, but also for other governments to recognize that the Russians, as well as others, can exploit elections for their own purposes and objectives.
And he's been pretty successful. He's had a pretty good year, has he not?
One might claim he does, yes.
He might claim he has.
And his many-hour press conference recently, he did say that he appreciated sort of all the support for his grand accomplishments. I don't think what he has accomplished in Syria is something that he should take pride in. They devastated that country, carried out attacks without concern, in my view, for innocent civilians being killed. He just supported the Bashar Assad regime. So has he been able to advance some of his relationships with foreign countries? Yes. Has he tried to take advantage of perceptions of U.S. Lack of leadership? Yes. So has he been able to interfere in an election here? Yes. But he also is being exposed for what he is doing.
You mentioned Syria. I've spent time with the president, obviously. Didn't get a chance to talk to him when we did one of these conversations a few weeks back. But obviously Syria is a painful episode would be too diminishing. It's a disaster. It's a humanitarian disaster. And you speak about Russia's role in it. One debate that will go on forever is, could the U.S. have done something else? President said in his press conference, the only thing we could have done is send in large numbers of troops, and then we would have been there, and we would have been there for a very, very long time. What could have been done?
Looking back, there's so many hypotheticals there. If we knew then what we know now in terms of what ISIL was able to do, in terms of just this explosive growth in Iraq that then is able to lop over into Syria, would we have pursued the same course? Probably not. ISIL didn't exist when the Arab Spring erupted in Syria. And if additional support was provided by various international actors to the Free Syrian Opposition, Free Syrian Army early on, might that have made a difference? Maybe. Because at that time, the Syrian regime was reeling, mm-hmm. and it was more vulnerable. Yet, the opposition in Syria, even in those early days and certainly over time, was a very eclectic one. There were those who were secular. There were those who were former members of the military, and then there were ones that were on the extremist end of the spectrum. And supporting the opposition blindly and throwing weapons over the transom into Syria could have led to a worse outcome than today.
Which was the president's expressed concern.
And that's what he was concerned about, that we really need to have a better understanding before providing support or military support. There's also issues of international law that we try to, respect and honor. Just because Russia doesn't respect and honor it when it comes to things like Ukraine, there needs to be a legal basis, an international legal basis for any type of military intervention. And when the Russians were opposed to it, that was the difference in the Balkans. So there were opportunities there to do something on the military front. But But absent a UN Security Council resolution to go in unilaterally, basically, and to try to dislodge a government, a recognized government, that has implications for future actions.
You said if we could have foreseen what was going to happen, is that an intelligence failure?
I'd say it's, you know, this issue of intelligence failure. What happens in the world is a result of so many things. What we do, what the Russians do, has tremendous implications for what events unfold in places like Syria or Iraq. You can never anticipate, as an intelligence professional, what your government is going to do, because especially in the United States, I mean, that has an impact. Did we not see that the Iraqi military was going to fold in the face of ISIL as quickly as it did? Yeah, we didn't. It was after the withdrawal of U.S. military there, the Iraqi forces, especially in the north, were basically Shia forces, and they were quickly overrun by the remnants of the Sunni elements of the Iraqi army that became part of ISIL, Daesh. So it had this momentum, and it had this engine that we didn't anticipate.
You know what some in Congress would say is that if we hadn't withdrawn the 25,000 troops or some number of troops, if we had left some number of troops there, that would have been forestalled.
Well, I think if we left some number of troops there, the history would have been different. I'm not saying that ISIL wouldn't have ultimately grown, but we would have had some serious decisions to make if we continued to have a military presence there and advisors in different parts of the country. People can make an argument that it was because of that withdrawal that led to that quick dissolution of the Iraqi military that ISIL was able to take advantage of.
And do you believe that?
I don't believe it was the reason for it. I think it was a contributing factor to the subsequent events that took place because we were not there. And we weren't able to do the training, we weren't able to do the advising and the assisting. Might it have turned out worse if we were there? Yeah. Might we have lost, you know, hundreds of U.S. military at the time? Might it have become even more of a rallying cry for ISIL? Yeah. So it's so hard to determine. But history would have been different. Without a doubt, it would have been different.
Just jumping back, one more question on Iraq. How different would history be if we hadn't gone in the first place in 2003?
If we hadn't gone into Iraq? Oh, it'd be tremendously different. The Middle East would not look like it does today. I do think that was the reason why there was the tremendous slide into violence and bloodshed in that part of the world that raged in Iraq for many years. And now ISIL is the outgrowth of that. Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator and a killer. He had repressed a lot of that animosity, tension, anger, and violence. But by taking him away without having then the ability to replace him or to succeed him with something that was going to be able to allow the successful war to give birth to a peace and an enduring political system is the reason why Iraq imploded, and the impact then on Syria was felt. So the history of the region would have been much different. Would it have, would the Arab Spring have been different? Yes, it would have been different as well. I'm not saying it would have been better, and who knows? Saddam Hussein might have decided to use those capabilities against another neighbor. But after he was pushed out of Kuwait in the 90s, I think he... And yes, he was a pain in the butt.
Yeah. And it's a podcast, say whatever you want.
But I do believe that what was unleashed as a result of that invasion was something that led to a Middle East of greater violence and bloodshed and chaos. And now we're still picking up the pieces from it.
You know, you mentioned Egypt earlier, and I remember those people in the square and filled with hope for democracy, and the events that followed the Muslim Brotherhood winning the election, and ultimately being overturned when they governed in a brutal an anti-democratic way. And now you have essentially another strongman in Egypt. Is there a future for democracy in that region?
Yeah, I think there were very, very unrealistic expectations in Washington, including in some parts of the administration, that the Arab Spring was going to push out these authoritarian regimes and democracy is going to flourish, because that's what people want. They want freedom. They want liberty. Not so much. They want it for themselves or their group or their tribe. But the concept of democracy is something that really is not ingrained in a lot of the people and the cultures and the countries out there. And so as we saw with the Muslim Brotherhood, they wanted to displace Mubarak. They wanted to gain political power and influence. But they didn't want to do it so that our concept of democracy was going to then take root. It was their version and their vision of what an Egypt should look like. And that's what I think we have to be very careful about, is not thinking that this great country of ours, of 240 years of experience, we're still working on this whole democratic principle. And quite, I must tell you, sometimes I question democracy, as Samantha Power says, you know, democracy is the worst form of government apart from all others.
Yes.
And when I think
stole
about...
Stole that from Churchill, but
yes,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. But when I think about what's going on in so many countries, and if everybody was to have a vote, I don't know whether or not the resultant government would, which I believe the government's a responsibility, would protect the rights of the minority. To me, that's what democracy is all about, that the government that is elected and the people and the officials that are elected, it's not just to promote the interests of those who elected that government. It's to ensure that those voices of the individuals of the minority are going to be safeguarded and protected.
As you leave and as we leave, let me ask you, what do you what's your greatest apprehension about the future? And what gives you hope? And give us a little hope, man, because I don't want to leave just on the apprehension.
I think that a number of countries around the globe are going to face real challenges in terms of meeting even the minimum requirements of their people in terms of what they need to exist, their economic interests, their political interests, and that the institutions of governance in these countries are not up to the task, and that the officials or the government leaders in many of these countries are not skilled enough or capable enough in order to navigate very, very difficult waters, and that corruption continues to exist, and that undermines the very fabric of the systems of governance. So, and terrorist organizations are able to attract the downtrodden, the disenfranchised, those that have given up hope. I see this wave not subsiding yet. And when I think about what we have over the next decade, I worry. At the same time, when I look at the history of the world in the last couple of centuries, there have been challenges in the past that because of man's innovation and evolution and development, the Industrial Revolution, technology, communication, we are able to find ways to advance the human condition. And I'm hoping that with some of these capabilities and breakthroughs, in ways that we can't even envision today, that we'll be able to nourish people. And it's not going to require arable land. It's not going to require rainfall. that there are going to be ways to at least take care of the very minimum basic requirements in order for people to live. So I have great hope in science and technology, and great hope that this country's great private sector and scientific and technological community are going to find ways that will be able to arrest this this downward slope in so many areas of the human condition, and so that we're not going to have the suffering and the humanitarian disasters and the conflict and the violence. I don't know if there's a way to prevent terrorists from using weapons and using, you know, fabricating IEDs. So with every technological innovation, the terrorists and the evildoers find ways to exploit it. I'd like to think that ultimately we're going to find a way to use this man's ingenuity to reverse the course of some many of these trends.
And for you, what's next?
On the 20th of January at noon, I will no longer be the director of CIA. I can't think of a better job ever than the director of CIA. So I will do something else. I want to reintroduce myself to my family, reintroduce myself to American culture. I don't know when the last time I saw a movie. Sleep. And then continue to be involved. I've spent a lot of time on national security issues. I'm not going to be silent. I may do some writing, speaking, commentating, or whatever from the sidelines.
Without constraints, that'll be fun.
Well, I like to think that there's some self-imposed constraints.
Yes,
I want to be respectful of those who I may criticize. And one of the things I'm very concerned about is the discourse that is taking place right now. And I was very fortunate to grow up in a household where politeness was something that my mother and father instilled in me and the nuns and Christian brothers, and being courteous. And when I look at some of the political environments and the language that is used and the words, I despair. And so I'm hoping that that discourse is going to elevate.
Well, let me just say you made a very important point in a very polite way there, I thought. And I will finish by saying what I've said to you and what I've said to others before, which is in the 2 years that I was at the White House, I always slept better knowing that you never slept. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate all the service that you've given this country.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's a privilege to be here, and I enjoy seeing you and talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.